He feels no particular pain now. But better than that, he feels no haste, no urgency to do anything or go anywhere. He just lies bleeding and quiet, knowing that after a while will be time enough to re-enter the world and time. He does not even wonder where Brown is gone. He does not have to think about Brown now. Again, his mind is filled with still shapes like discarded and fragmentary toys of childhood, piled indiscriminate and gathering quiet dust in a forgotten closet. Brown, Lena Grove, Hightower, Byron Bunch, all like small objects which had never been alive, which he had played with in childhood and then broken and forgot. He is lying so when he hears the train whistle for a crossing a half mile away. This rouses him. This is the world and time, too. He sits up slowly, tentatively. Anyway, I ain't broke anything, he thinks. I mean, he ain't broke anything that belongs to me. It is getting late. It is time now, with distance, moving in it. Yes. I'll have to be moving. I'll have to get on so I can find me something else to meddle with. The train is coming nearer. Already the stroke of the engine has shortened and become heavier as it begins to feel the grade. Presently he can see the smoke. He seeks in his pocket for a handkerchief. He has none, so he tears the tail from his shirt and dabs at his face gingerly, listening to the short, blasting reports of the locomotive exhaust just over the grade. He moves to the edge of the undergrowth, where he can see the track. The engine is in sight now, almost head-on to him beneath the spaced, heavy blasts of black smoke. It has an effect of terrific no-motion. Yet it does move, creeping terrifically up and over the crest of the grade. Standing now in the fringe of bushes, he watches the engine approach and pass him, laboring, crawling, with the rapt and boy-like absorption, and perhaps yearning, of his country raising. It passes. His eye moves on, watching the cars as they in turn crawl up and over the crest, when for the second time that afternoon he sees a man materialize apparently out of air in the act of running. Even then he does not realize what Brown is about. He has progressed too far into peace and solitude to wonder. He just stands there and watches Brown run to the train, stooping, fleeing, and grasp the iron ladder at the end of a car and leap upward and vanish from sight as though sucked into a vacuum. The train is beginning to increase its speed. He watches the approach of the car where Brown vanished. It passes. Clinging to the rear of it, between it and the next car, Brown stands, his face leaned out and watching the bushes. They see one another at the same moment. The two faces, the mild, nondescript, bloody one and the lean, harried, desperate one, contorted now in a soundless shouting above the noise of the train, passing one another as though on opposite orbits and with an effect as of phantoms or apparitions. Still, Byron is not thinking. Great God in the mountain, he says, with childlike and almost ecstatic astonishment. He sure knows how to jump a train. He's sure done that before. He is not thinking at all. It is as though the moving wall of dingy cars were a dike beyond which the world, time, hope, unbelievable and certainty incontrovertible waited, giving him yet a little more of peace. Anyway, when the last car passes, moving fast now, the world rushes down on him like a flood, a tidal wave. It is too huge and fast for distance and time. Hence no path to be retraced, leading the mule for a good way before he remembers to get on it and ride. It is as though he has already and long since outstripped himself, already waiting at the cabin until he can catch up and enter. And then I will stand there and I will... He tries it again. Then I will stand there and I will... But he can get no further than that. He is in the road again now, approaching a wagon homeward bound from town. It is about 6 o'clock. He does not give up, however. Even if I can't seem to get any further than that, when I will open the door and come in and stand there, and then I will look at her. Look at her. Look at her. The voice speaks again.
Excitement, I reckon.
What? Byron says. The wagon has halted. He is right beside it. The mule stopped too. On the wagon seat, the man speaks again in his flat, complaining voice.
Darn the luck. Just when I had to get started for home. I'm already late.
Excitement? Byron says. What excitement? The man is looking at him.
From your face, a man would say you had been in some excitement yourself.
I fell down, Byron says.
What excitement in town this evening? I thought maybe you hadn't heard.
About an hour ago.
That nigger, Christmas.
They killed him.
Chapter 19. About the supper tables on that Monday night, what the town wondered at was not so much how Christmas had escaped, but why, when free, he had taken refuge in the place which he did, where he must have known he would be certainly run to earth, and why, when that occurred, he neither surrendered nor resisted. It was as though he had set out and made his plans to passively commit suicide. There were many reasons, opinions, as to why he had fled to Hightower's house at the last. Like to like, the easy, the immediate one said, remembering the old tales about the minister. Some believed it to have been sheer chance. Others said that the man had shown wisdom, since he would not have been suspected of being in the minister's house at all if someone had not seen him run across the backyard and run into the kitchen. Gavin Stevens, though, had a different theory. He is the district attorney, a Harvard graduate, a Phi Beta Kappa, a tall, loose-jointed man with a constant cob pipe, with an untidy mop of iron-gray hair, wearing always loose and unpressed dark-gray clothes. His family is old in Jefferson. His ancestors owned slaves there, and his grandfather knew, and also hated and publicly congratulated Colonel Sardaris when they died, Miss Burden's grandfather and brother. He has an easy, quiet way with country people, with the voters and the juries. He can be seen now and then squatting among the overalls on the porches of country stores for a whole summer afternoon, talking to them in their own idiom about nothing at all. On this Monday night, there descended from the 9 o'clock southbound train a college professor from the neighboring state university, a schoolmate of Stevens's at Harvard, come to spend a few days of the vacation with his friend. When he descended from the train, he saw his friend at once. He believed that Stevens had come down to meet him until he saw that Stevens was engaged with a queer-looking old couple whom he was putting on the train. Looking at them, the professor saw a little, dirty old man with a short goat's beard who seemed to be in a state like catalepsy, and an old woman who must have been his wife. A dumpy creature with a face like dough beneath a nodding and soiled white plume, shapeless in a silk dress of an outmoded shape and in color regal and moribund. For an instant the professor paused in a sort of astonished interest, watching Stevens putting into the woman's hand, as into the hand of a child, 2 railroad tickets. Moving again and approaching and still unseen by his friend, he overheard Stevens's final words as the flagman helped the old people into the vestibule. Yes, yes, Stevens was saying, in a tone soothing and recapitulant. He'll be on the train tomorrow morning. I'll see to it. All you'll have to do is to arrange for the funeral, the cemetery. You take Granddad on home and put him to bed. I'll see that the boy is on the train in the morning. Then the train began to move, and Stevens turned and saw the professor. He began the story as they rode to town and finished it as they sat on the veranda of Stevens's home, and there recapitulated.
I think I know why it was. Why he ran into Hightower's house for refuge at the last. I think it was his grandmother. She had just been with him in his cell when they took him back to the courthouse again. She and the grandfather, that little crazed old man who wanted to lynch him, who came up here from Mottstown for that purpose. I don't think that the old lady had any hope of saving him when she came. Any actual hope. I believe that all she wanted was that he die decent, as she put it. Decently hung by a force, a principle. Not burned or hacked or dragged dead by a thing. I think she came here just to watch that old man, lest he be the straw that started the hurricane, because she did not dare let him out of her sight. Not that she doubted that Christmas was her grandchild, you understand. She just didn't hope. Didn't know how to begin to hope. I imagine that after 30 years, the machinery for hoping requires more than 24 hours to get started, to get into motion again. But I believe that, having got started physically by the tide of the old man's insanity and conviction, before she knew it, she had been swept away too. So they came here. They got here on the early train about 3 o'clock Sunday morning. She made no attempt to see Christmas. Perhaps she was watching the old man. But I don't think so. I don't think that the hoping machine had got started then either. I don't think that it ever did start until that baby was born out there this morning. Born right in her face, you might say. A boy, too. And she had never seen the mother before, and the father at all, and that grandson whom she had never seen as a man. So to her, those 30 years just were not. Obliterated when that child cried. No longer existed. It was all coming down on her too fast. There was too much reality that her hands and eyes could not deny, and too much that must be taken for granted that her hands and eyes could not prove. Too much of the inexplicable that hands and eyes were asked too suddenly to accept and believe without proof. After the 30 years, it must have been like a person in solitary blundering suddenly into a room full of strange people all talking at once. And she casting desperately about for anything that would hold sanity together by choosing some logical course of action which would be within her limitations, which she could have some assurance of being able to perform. Until that baby was born and she found some means by which she could stand alone, as it were, she had been like an effigy with a mechanical voice being hauled about on a cart by that fella bunch and made to speak when he gave the signal, as when he took her last night to tell her story to Dr. Hightower. And she was still groping, you see. She was still trying to find something which that mind, which had apparently not run very much in 30 years, could believe in, admit to be actual, real. And I think that she found it there, at Hightower's, for the first time. Someone to whom she could tell it, who would listen to her. Very likely that was the first time she had ever told it. And very likely she learned it herself then for the first time, actually saw it whole and real at the same time with Hightower. So I don't think it is so strange that for the time she got not only the child but his parentage as well mixed up,
since in that cabin those 30 years did not exist. The child and its father whom she had never seen, and her grandson whom she had not seen since he was a baby like the other, and whose father likewise to her had never existed, all confused. And that when hope did begin to move in her, she should have turned at once with that sublime and boundless faith of her kind in those who are the voluntary slaves and the sworn bondsmen of prayer to the minister. That's what she was telling Christmas in the jail today, when the old man, watching his chance, had slipped away from her and she followed him to town and found him on the street corner again, mad as a hatter and completely hoarse, preaching lynching, telling the people how he had grandfathered the devil's spawn and had kept it in trust for this day. Or perhaps she was on her way to see him in the jail when she left the cabin. Anyway, she left the old man alone as soon as she saw that his audience was more interested than moved, and went on to the sheriff. He had just got back from dinner, and for a while he could not understand what she wanted. She must have sounded quite crazy to him with that story of hers, in that hopelessly respectable Sunday dress, planning a jailbreak. But he let her go to the jail with a deputy. And there, in the cell with him, I believe she told him about Hightower, that Hightower would save him, was going to save him. But of course I don't know what she told him. I don't believe that any man could reconstruct that scene. I don't think that she knew herself, planned at all what she would say, because it had already been written and worded for her on the night when she bore his mother, and that was now so long ago that she had learned it beyond all forgetting and then forgot the words. Perhaps that's why he believed her at once, without question. I mean, because she did not worry about what to say, about plausibility or the possibility of incredulity on his part. That somewhere, somehow, in the shape or presence or whatever of that old outcast minister was a sanctuary which would be inviolable not only to officers and mobs, but to the very irrevocable past. To whatever crimes had molded and shaped him and left him at last high and dry in a barred cell with the shape of an incipient executioner everywhere he looked. And he believed her. I think that is what gave him not the courage so much as the passive patience to endure and recognize and accept the one opportunity which he had to break in the middle of that crowded square, manacled, and run. But there was too much running with him, stride for stride with him. Not pursuers, but himself. Years, acts, deeds omitted and committed, keeping pace with him, stride for stride, breath for breath, thud for thud of the heart, using a single heart. It was not alone all those 30 years which she did not know, but all those successions of 30 years before that which had put that stain either on his white blood or his black blood, whichever you will, and which killed him. But he must have run with believing for a while. Anyway, with hope. But his blood would not be quiet. Let him save it. It would not be either one or the other and let his body save itself. Because the black blood drove him first to the Negro cabin. And then the white blood drove him out of there, as it was the black blood which snatched up the pistol and the white blood which would not let him fire it. And it was the white blood which sent him to the minister, which, rising in him for the last and final time, sent him against all reason and all reality into the embrace of a chimera, a blind faith in something read in a printed book. Then I believe that the white blood deserted him for the moment. Just a second, a flicker, allowing the black to rise in its final moment and make him turn upon that on which he had postulated his hope of salvation. It was the black blood which swept him by his own desire beyond the aid of any man, swept him up into that ecstasy out of a black jungle where life has already ceased before the heart stops and death is desire and fulfillment. And then the black blood failed him again, as it must have in crises all his life. He did not kill the minister. He merely struck him with the pistol and ran on and crouched behind that table and defied the black blood for the last time, as he had been defying it for 30 years. He crouched behind that overturned table and let them shoot him to death with that loaded and unfired pistol in his hand. In the town on that day lived a young man named Percy Grimm. He was about 25 and a captain in the State National Guard. He had been born in the town and had lived there all his life, save for the periods of the summer encampments. He was too young to have been in the European War, though it was not until 1921 or 22 that he realized that he would never forgive his parents for that fact. His father, a hardware merchant, did not understand this. He thought that the boy was just lazy and in a fair way to become perfectly worthless, when in reality the boy was suffering the terrible tragedy of having been born not alone too late, but not late enough to have escaped first-hand knowledge of the lost time when he should have been a man instead of a child. And now, with the hysteria passed away and the ones who had been loudest in the hysteria, and even the heroes who had suffered and served, beginning to look at one another a little askance, he had no one to tell it, to open his heart to. In fact, his first serious fight was with an ex-soldier who made some remark to the effect that if he had to do it again, he would fight this time on the German side and against France. At once, Grimm took him up. "Against America, too?" he said. "If America's fool enough to help France out again," the soldier said. Grimm struck him at once. He was smaller than the soldier, still in his teens. The result was foregone. Even Grimm doubtless knew that. But he took his punishment until even the soldier begged the bystanders to hold the boy back. And he wore the scars of that battle as proudly as he was later to wear the uniform itself, for which he had blindly fought. It was the new civilian military act which saved him. He was like a man who had been for a long time in a swamp, in the dark. It was as though he not only could see no path ahead of him, he knew that there was none. Then suddenly, his life opened, definite and clear. The wasted years in which he had shown no ability in school, in which he had been known as lazy, recalcitrant, without ambition, were behind him, forgotten. He could now see his life opening before him, uncomplex and inescapable as a barren corridor, completely freed now of ever again having to think or decide. The burden which he now assumed and carried as bright and weightless and martial as his insignatory brass, a sublime and implicit faith in physical courage and blind obedience, and a belief that the white race is superior to any and all other races, and that the American is superior to all other white races, and that the American uniform is superior to all men. And that all that would ever be required of him in payment for this belief, this privilege, would be his own life. On each national holiday that had any martial flavor whatever, he dressed in his captain's uniform and came downtown. And those who saw him remembered him again on the day of the fight with the ex-soldier as, glittering, with his marksman's badge, he was a fine shot, and his bars, grave, erect, he walked among the civilians with about him an air half belligerent and half the self-conscious pride of a boy. He was not a member of the American Legion, but that was his parents' fault and not his. But when Christmas was fetched back from Mottstown on that Saturday afternoon, he had already been to the commander of the local post. His idea, his words, were quite simple and direct. "We got to preserve order," he said. "We must let the law take its course. The law, the nation. It is the right of no civilian to sentence a man to death. And we, the soldiers in Jefferson, are the ones to see to that."
"How do you know that anybody is planning anything different?" the Legion commander said. "Have you heard any talk?"
"I don't know. I haven't listened." He didn't lie. It was as though he did not attach enough importance to what might or might not have been said by the civilian citizens to lie about it. "That's not the question. It's whether or not we, as soldiers, that have worn the uniform, are going to be the first to state where we stand. To show these people right off just where the government of the country stands on such things. That there won't be any need for them even to talk." His plan was quite simple. It was to form the Legion post into a platoon, with himself in command, vide his active commission. "But if they don't want me to command, that's all right, too. I'll be second if they say. Or a sergeant or a corporal." And he meant it. It was not vainglory that he wanted. He was too sincere. So sincere, so humorless, that the Legion commander withheld the flippant refusal he was about to make. "I still don't think that there is any need of it. And if there was, we would all have to act as civilians. I couldn't use the post like that. After all, we are not soldiers now. I don't think I would if I could." Grimm looked at him, without anger, but rather as if he were some kind of bug. "Yet you wore the uniform once," he said, with a kind of patience. He said, "I suppose you won't use your authority to keep me from talking to them, will you? As individuals?" "No, I haven't any authority to do that anyway. But just as individuals, mind, you mustn't use my name at all." Then Grimm gave him a shot on his own account. "I am not likely to do that," he said. Then he was gone. That was Saturday, about 4 o'clock. For the rest of that afternoon, he circulated about the stores and offices where the Legion members worked, so that by nightfall he had enough of them also worked up to his own pitch to compose a fair platoon. He was indefatigable, restrained yet forceful. There was something about him irresistible and prophet-like. Yet the recruits were with the commander in one thing. The official designation of the Legion must be kept out of it. Whereupon, and without deliberate intent, he had gained his original end. He was now in command. He got them all together just before supper time and divided them into squads and appointed officers and a staff. The younger ones, the ones who had not gone to France, taking proper fire by now. He addressed them, briefly, coldly. "Order. Course of justice. Let the people see that we who have worn the uniform of the United States. And one thing more." For the moment now he had descended to familiarity. The regimental commander who knows his men by their first names. "I'll leave this to you fellas. I'll do what you say. I thought it might be a good thing if I wear my uniform until this business is settled, so they can see that Uncle Sam is present in more than spirit." "But he's not," one said quickly, immediately. He was of the same cut as the commander, who, by the way, was not present. "This is not government trouble yet. Kennedy might not like it. This is Jefferson's trouble, not Washington's." "Make him like it," Grimm said. What does your legion stand for if not for the protection of America and Americans?
No, the other said. I reckon we better not make a parade out of this. We can do what we want without that.
Better. Ain't that right, boys?
All right, Grimm said. I'll do as you say.
But every man will want a pistol. We'll have a small arms inspection here in 1 hour. Every man will report here.
What's Kennedy going to say about pistols? One said.
I'll see to that, Grimm said.
Report here in 1 hour exactly, with sidearms.
He dismissed them. He crossed the quiet square to the sheriff's office. The sheriff was at home, they told him.
At home? He repeated.
Now?
What's he doing at home now?
Eating, I reckon. A man as big as him has got to eat several times a day.
At home, Grimm repeated.
He did not glare. It was again that cold and detached expression with which he had looked at the Legion commander.
Eating, he said.
He went out, already walking fast. He recrossed the empty square, the quiet square empty of people peacefully at supper tables about that peaceful town and that peaceful country. He went to the sheriff's home. The sheriff said no at once.
15 or 20 folks milling around the square with pistols in their pants?
No, no. That won't do. I can't have that. That won't do. You let me run this.
For a moment longer, Grimm looked at the sheriff. Then he turned, already walking fast again.
All right, he said. If that's the way you want it. I don't interfere with you, and you don't interfere with me, then.
It didn't sound like a threat. It was too flat, too final, too without heat. He went on rapidly. The sheriff watched him. Then he called. Grimm turned.
You leave yours at home, too, the sheriff said. You hear me?
Grimm didn't answer. He went on. The sheriff watched him out of sight, frowning. That evening after supper, the sheriff went back downtown. Something he had not done for years, save when urgent and inescapable business called. He found a picket of Grimm's men at the jail, and another in the courthouse, and a third patrolling the square and the adjacent streets. The others, the relief, they told the sheriff, were in the cotton office where Grimm was employed, which they were using for an orderly room, a PC. The sheriff met Grimm on the street, making a round of inspection.
Come here, boy, the sheriff said.
Grimm halted. He did not approach. The sheriff went to him. He patted Grimm's hip with a fat hand.
I told you to leave that at home, he said.
Grimm said nothing. He watched the sheriff levelly. The sheriff sighed.
Well, if you won't, I reckon I'll have to make you a special deputy. But you ain't to even show that gun unless I tell you to. You hear me?
Certainly not, Grimm said. You certainly wouldn't want me to draw it if I didn't see any need to.
I mean not till I tell you to.
Certainly, Grimm said, without heat, patiently, immediately. That's what we both said.
Don't you worry.
I'll be there. Later, as the town quieted for the night, as the picture show emptied and the drug stores closed one by one, Grimm's platoon began to drop off too. He did not protest, watching them coldly. They became a little sheepish, defensive. Again, without knowing it, he had played a trump card. Because of the fact that they felt sheepish, feeling that somehow they had fallen short of his own cold ardor, they would return tomorrow if just to show him. A few remained. It was Saturday night anyhow, and someone got more chairs from somewhere and they started a poker game. It ran all night, though from time to time Grimm, he was not in the game. Neither would he permit his second in command, the only other there who held the equivalent of commissioned rank, to engage. Sent a squad out to make a patrol of the square. By this time the night marshal was one of them, though he too did not take a hand in the game. Sunday was quiet. The poker game ran quietly through that day, broken by the periodical patrols, while the quiet church bells rang and the congregations gathered in decorous clumps of summer colors. About the square it was already known that the special grand jury would meet tomorrow. Somehow the very sound of the two words, with their evocation secret and irrevocable, and something of a hidden and unsleeping and omnipotent eye watching the doings of men, began to reassure Grimm's men in their own make-believe. So quickly is man unwittingly and unpredictably moved that without knowing that they were thinking it, the town had suddenly accepted Grimm with respect and perhaps a little awe and a deal of actual faith and confidence, as though somehow his vision and patriotism and pride in the town, the occasion, had been quicker and truer than theirs. His men, anyway, assumed and accepted this. After the sleepless night, the tenseness, the holiday, the suttee of volition's surrender, they were almost at the pitch where they might die for him if occasion rose. They now moved in a grave and slightly awe-inspiring reflected light which was almost as palpable as the khaki would have been which Grimm wished them to wear, wished that they wore, as though each time they returned to the orderly room they dressed themselves anew in suave and austerely splendid scraps of his dream. This lasted through Sunday night. The poker game ran. The caution, the surreptitiousness which had clothed it was now gone. There was something about it, too, assured and serenely confident to be braggadocio. Tonight, when they heard the marshal's feet on the stairs, one said, "Where MPs?" And for an instant they glanced at one another with hard, bright, daredevil eyes. Then one said, quite loud, "Throw the son of a bitch out," and another through pursed lips made the immemorial sound. And so the next morning, Monday, when the first country cars and wagons began to gather, the platoon was again intact, and they now wore uniforms. It was their faces. Most of them were of an age, a generation, an experience. But it was more than that. They now had a profound and bleak gravity as they stood where crowds milled, grave, austere, detached, looking with blank, bleak eyes at the slow throngs who, feeling, sensing without knowing, drifted before them, slowing, staring, so that they would be ringed with faces rapt and empty and immobile as the faces of cows, approaching and drifting on to be replaced. And all morning the voices came and went in quiet question and answer. "There he goes. That young fellow with the automatic pistol. He's the captain of them. Special officer sent by the governor. He's the head of the whole thing. Sheriff ain't got no say in it today." Later, when it was too late, Grimm told the sheriff, "If you had just listened to me, let me bring him out of that cell in a squad of men, instead of sending him across the square with one deputy and not even handcuffed to him, in all that crowd where that damn Buford didn't dare shoot, even if he could hit a barn door. How did I know he aimed to break? Would think of trying it right then and there," the sheriff said. "When Stevens had done told me he would plead guilty and take a life sentence." But it was too late then. It was all over then. It happened in the middle of the square, halfway between the sidewalk and the courthouse, in the midst of a throng of people thick as on fair day, though the first that Grimm knew of it was when he heard the deputy's pistol twice, fired into the air. He knew at once what had happened, though he was at the time inside the courthouse. His reaction was definite and immediate. He was already running toward the shots when he shouted back over his shoulder at the man who had tagged him now for almost 48 hours as half aide and half orderly, "Turn in the fire alarm."
"The fire alarm?" the aide said.
"What?" "Turn in the fire alarm," Grimm shouted back. "It don't matter what folks think just so they know that something..."
He did not finish. He was gone.
He ran among running people, overtaking and passing them, since he had an objective and they did not. They were just running. The black, blunt, huge automatic opening a way for him like a plow. They looked at his tense, hard young face with faces blanched and gaped with round, toothed orifices. They made one long sound like a murmuring sigh.
"There. Went that way."
But already Grimm had seen the deputy, running, his pistol aloft in his hand. Grimm glanced once about and sprang forward again. In the throng which had evidently been pacing the deputy and the prisoner across the square was the inevitable hulking youth in the uniform of the Western Union, leading his bicycle by the horns like a docile cow. Grimm rammed the pistol back into the holster and flung the boy aside and sprang onto the bicycle with never a break in motion. The bicycle possessed neither horn nor bell. Yet they sensed him somehow and made way. In this, too, he seemed to be served by certitude, the blind and untroubled faith in the rightness and infallibility of his actions. When he overtook the running deputy, he slowed the bicycle. The deputy turned upon him a face sweating, gaped with shouting and running.
"He turned," the deputy screamed. "Into that alley by..."
"I know," Grimm said. "Was he handcuffed?"
"Yes,"
the deputy said. The bicycle leaped on. "Then he can't run very fast," Grimm thought. "He'll have to hole up soon. Get out of the open, anyway." He turned into the alley, fast. It ran back between two houses, with a board fence on one side. At that moment, the fire siren sounded for the first time, beginning and mounting to a slow and sustained scream that seemed at last to pass beyond the realm of hearing into that of sense, like soundless vibration. Grimm wheeled on, thinking swiftly, logically, with a kind of fierce and constrained joy. "The first thing he will want is to get out of sight," he thought, looking about. On one hand, the lane was open. On the other stood the board fence, 6 feet high. At the end, it was cut short off by a wooden gate, beyond which was a pasture and then a deep ditch, which was a town landmark. The tops of tall trees which grew in it just showed above the rim. A regiment could hide and deploy in it. "Ah," he said aloud. Without stopping or slowing, he swept the bicycle around and pedaled back down the lane toward the street which he had just quitted. The wail of the siren was dying now, descending back into hearing again, and as he slewed the bicycle into the street, he saw briefly the running people and a car bearing down upon him. For all his pedaling, the car overtook him. Its occupants leaned, shouting toward his set, forward-looking face.
"Get in here," they shouted. "In here."
He did not answer. He did not look at them. The car had overshot him, slowing. Now he passed it at his swift, silent, steady pace. Again the car speeded up and passed him, the men leaning out and looking ahead. He was going fast, too, silent, with the delicate swiftness of an apparition, the implacable undeviation of juggernaut or fate. Behind him the siren began again its rising wail. When next the man in the car looked back for him, he had vanished completely. He had turned full speed into another lane. His face was rock-like, calm, still bright with that expression of fulfillment, of grave and reckless joy. This lane was more rutted than the other, and deeper. It came out at last upon a barren knoll where, springing to earth while the bicycle shot on, falling, he could see the full span of the ravine along the edge of town, his view of it broken by two or three Negro cabins which lined the edge of it. He was quite motionless, still, alone, fateful, like a landmark almost. Again from the town behind him the scream of the siren began to fall. Then he saw Christmas. He saw the man, small with distance, appear up out of the ditch, his hands close together. As Grimm watched, he saw the fugitive's hands glint once like the flash of a heliograph as the sun struck the handcuffs, and it seemed to him that even from here he could hear the panting and desperate breath of the man who even now was not free. Then the tiny figure ran again and vanished beyond the nearest Negro cabin. Grimm ran too now. He ran swiftly, yet there was no haste about him, no effort. There was nothing vengeful about him either, no fury, no outrage. Christmas saw that himself, because for an instant they looked at one another almost face to face. That was when Grimm, running, was in the act of passing beyond the corner of the cabin. At that instant, Christmas leaped from the rear window of it with an effect as of magic, his manacled hands high and now glinting as if they were on fire. For an instant, they glared at one another, the one stopped in the act of crouching from the leap, the other in mid-stride of running, before Grimm's momentum carried him past the corner. In that instant, he saw that Christmas now carried a heavy nickel-plated pistol. Grimm whirled and turned and sprang back past the corner, drawing the automatic. He was thinking swiftly, calmly, with that quiet joy. He can do two things. He can try for the ditch again, or he can dodge around the house until one of us gets a shot. And the ditch is on his side of the house. He reacted immediately. He ran at full speed around the corner which he had just turned. He did it as though under the protection of a magic or a providence, or as if he knew that Christmas would not be waiting there with the pistol. He ran on past the next corner without pausing. He was beside the ditch now. He stopped, motionless in mid-stride. Above the blunt, cold rake of the automatic, his face had that serene, unearthly luminousness of angels in church windows. He was moving again almost before he had stopped, with that lean, swift, blind obedience to whatever player moved him on the board. He ran to the ditch. But in the beginning of his plunge downward into the brush that choked the steep descent, he turned, clawing. He saw now that the cabin sat some 2 feet above the earth. He had not noticed it before in his haste. He knew now that he had lost a point, that Christmas had been watching his legs all the time beneath the house. He said, "Good man." His plunge carried him some distance before he could stop himself and climb back out. He seemed indefatigable, not flesh and blood, as if the player who moved him for pawn likewise found him breath. Without a pause, in the same surge that carried him up out of the ditch again, he was running again. He ran around the cabin in time to see Christmas fling himself over a fence 300 yards away. He did not fire, because Christmas was now running through a small garden and straight toward a house. Running, he saw Christmas leap up the back steps and enter the house. "Ha," Grimm said, "the preacher's house. Hightower's house." He did not slow, though he swerved and ran around the house and to the street. The car which had passed him and lost him and then returned was just where it should have been, just where the player had desired it to be. It stopped without signal from him, and 3 men got out. Without a word, Grimm turned and ran across the yard and into the house where the old, disgraced minister lived alone, and the 3 men followed, rushing into the hall, pausing, bringing with them into its stale and cloistral dimness something of the savage summer sunlight which they had just left. It was upon them, of them, its shameless savageness. Out of it their faces seemed to glare with bodiless suspension, as though from halos, as they stooped and raised Hightower, his face bleeding from the floor where Christmas, running up the hall, his raised and armed and manacled hands full of glare and glitter like lightning bolts, so that he resembled a vengeful and furious god pronouncing a doom, had struck him down. They held the old man on his feet. "Which room?" Grimm said, shaking him. "Which room, old man?"
"Gentlemen," Hightower said. Then he said, "Men. Men."
"Which room, old man?" Grimm shouted. They held Hightower on his feet. In the gloomy hall, after the sunlight, he too, with his bald head and his big, pale face streaked with blood, was terrible. "Men," he cried. "Listen to me. He was here that night. He was with me the night of the murder. I swear to God." "Jesus Christ," Grimm cried, his young voice clear and outraged like that of a young priest. "Has every preacher and old maid in Jefferson taken their pants down to the yellow-bellied son of a bitch?" He flung the old man aside and ran on. It was as though he had been merely waiting for the player to move him again, because with that unfailing certitude he ran straight to the kitchen and into the doorway, already firing, almost before he could have seen the table overturned and standing on its edge across the corner of the room, and the bright and glittering hands of the man who crouched behind it, resting upon the upper edge. Grimm emptied the automatic's magazine into the table. Later, someone covered all five shots with a folded handkerchief. But the player was not done yet. When the others reached the kitchen, they saw the table flung aside now, and Grimm stooping over the body. When they approached to see what he was about, they saw that the man was not dead yet. And when they saw what Grimm was doing, one of the men gave a choked cry and stumbled back into the wall and began to vomit. Then Grimm, too, sprang back, flinging behind him the bloody butcher knife. "Now you'll let white women alone, even in hell," he said. But the man on the floor had not moved. He just lay there, with his eyes open and empty of everything save consciousness, and with something, a shadow, about his mouth. For a long moment he looked up at them with peaceful and unfathomable and unbearable eyes. Then his face, body, all, seemed to collapse, to fall in upon itself, and from out the slashed garments about his hips and loins, the pent black blood seemed to rush like a released breath. It seemed to rush out of his pale body like the rush of sparks from a rising rocket. Upon that black blast, the man seemed to rise, soaring into their memories forever and ever. They are not to lose it, in whatever peaceful valleys, beside whatever placid and reassuring streams of old age, in the mirroring faces of whatever children they will contemplate old disasters and newer hopes. It will be there, musing, quiet, steadfast, not fading and not particularly threatful, but of itself alone serene, of itself alone triumphant. Again from the town, deadened a little by the walls, the scream of the siren mounted toward its unbelievable crescendo, passing out of the realm of hearing. Chapter 20. Now the final copper light of afternoon fades. Now the street beyond the low maples and the low signboard is prepared and empty, framed by the study window like a stage. He can remember how, when he was young, after he first came to Jefferson from the seminary, how that fading copper light would seem almost audible, like a dying yellow fall of trumpets dying into an interval of silence and waiting, out of which they would presently come. Already, even before the falling horns had ceased, it would seem to him that he could hear the beginning thunder not yet louder than a whisper, a rumor in the air. But he had never told anyone that. Not even her. Not even her in the days when they were still the night's lovers, and shame and division had not come, and she knew and had not forgot with division and regret and then despair why he would sit here at this window and wait for nightfall, for the instant of night. Not even to her, to woman. The woman. Woman, not the seminary, as he had once believed. The passive and anonymous, whom God had created to be not alone the recipient and receptacle of the seed of his body, but of his spirit too, which is truth or as near truth as he dare approach. He was an only child. When he was born, his father was 50 years old, and his mother had been an invalid for almost 20 years. He grew up to believe that this was the result of the food which she had had to subsist on during the last year of the Civil War. Perhaps this was the reason. His father had owned no slaves, though he was the son of a man who did own slaves at the time. He could have owned them. But though born and bred and dwelling in an age and land where to own slaves was less expensive than to not own them, he would neither eat food grown and cooked by, nor sleep in a bed prepared by, a Negro slave. Hence, during the war and while he was absent from home, his wife had no garden save what she could make herself or with the infrequent aid of neighbors. And this aid the husband would not allow her to accept for the reason that it could not be repaid in kind. "God will provide," he said. "Provide what? Dandelions and ditch weeds? Then he will give us the bowels to digest them." He was a minister. For a year he had been leaving home early each Sunday morning before his father, this was before the son's marriage, who, though a member in good standing of the Episcopal Church, had not entered any church since the son could remember, discovered where he went. He found that the son, then just turned 21, was riding 16 miles each Sunday to preach in a small Presbyterian chapel back in the hills. The father laughed. The son listened to the laughter as he would if it had been shouts or curses, with a cold and respectful detachment, saying nothing. The next Sunday, he went back to his congregation. When the war began, the son was not among the first to go. Neither was he among the last. And he stayed with the troops for 4 years, though he fired no musket and wore instead of uniform the somber frock coat which he had purchased to be married in and which he had used to preach in. When he returned home in 65, he still wore it, though he never put it on again after that day when the wagon stopped at the front steps and 2 men lifted him down and carried him into the house and laid him on the bed. His wife removed the coat and put it away in a trunk in the attic. It stayed there for 25 years, until one day his son opened the trunk and took it out and spread out the careful folds in which it had been arranged by hands that were now dead. He remembers it now. Sitting in the dark window in the quiet study, waiting for twilight to cease, for night and the galloping hooves. The copper light has completely gone now. The world hangs in a green suspension in color and texture like light through colored glass. Soon it will be time to begin to say, "Soon now. Now soon." "I was 8 then," he thinks. It was raining. It seems to him that he can still smell the rain, the moist grieving of the October earth, and the musty yawn as the lid of the trunk went back. Then the garment, the neat folds. He did not know what it was, because at first he was almost overpowered by the evocation of his dead.